You know that economic poll we released this week? The one that says, yeah, the economy is growing, but people aren't feeling it? The Commerce Department backed us up on that first bit today. We will back up the second bit ourselves on the program from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Thursday, the 29th of October. Great, as always, to have you along. The report in question from the Commerce Department this morning was the first guess at gross domestic product for the third quarter, that is July through September. It clocked in at an annualized rate of 1.5%. That is a big tumble from the almost 4% bump this past spring. Of course, the fine print reading commenced as soon as the report hit, and it turns out that something called private business inventory, stuff sitting on a shelf somewhere in a factory or a warehouse or a store, stuff that hasn't been sold to the final user yet, those inventories declined, which in turn took a big chunk out of the GDP number overall. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has the explanation.
Let's start with a business that actually has inventory on its shelves.
You know, it's ion beams and electron beams, x-rays. It's like Buck Rogers.
Randy Delwo runs a small company that makes precision scientific instruments for industry and university labs.
We pay very close to our inventory when we order parts from vendors that we use to assemble products like sputter ion guns or analyzers or things like this.
Delwo wants to run a tight ship and not let his parts supplies get out ahead of his upcoming orders. Economists watch inventories, too, to judge how the whole economy's doing. Here's Bernie Baumol at the Economic Outlook Group.
What companies decided to do was fill the orders from consumers and businesses by drawing down from the existing inventory that they have.
But Baumol doesn't think they did that because they're convinced the economy's slowing and they don't want expensive supplies sitting on their shelves. Rather, he says inventories piled up earlier this year after a port strike and bad winter weather. That's done with, and going forward, he says businesses are pretty optimistic.
The very fact that we've had this drawdown in inventories does set the stage for companies to start filling up their stock rooms and their backlots, and that should add to GDP growth in the fourth quarter.
Randy Delwo, by the way, sees just that trend. He's building inventory and expects higher sales of his scientific instruments in 2016. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
In between all the yelling and finger-pointing at the GOP primary debate last night, there were actually some economic policy points being bandied about. Among them was the flat tax. It's made increasingly frequent appearances in American elections since the 1990s or so. But as Marketplace's Sabri Benishour reports, the flat tax, or rather the debate over it, has a much longer history than that.
It's flat tax for presidents.
I rolled up my tax plan today.
You have a flat tax plan.
About my tax plan and how
it is a simple flat tax.
This is actually not America's first flat tax rodeo. Not even close.
There are two instances where we actually enacted a flat income tax. One was in 1862 during the Civil War, and the other was in 1894.
Stephen Bank is a professor of law at UCLA.
Neither lasted long.
The first flat tax was ditched before it was ever enforced. The second was struck down by the Supreme Court. The U.S. debated a flat tax again in 1913 when the income tax was created. Here's how that debate went.
Not only should we have graduated rates, but we have to have steeply graduated rates. We need to redistribute income.
Others said, no way.
It's confiscation from the rich. It's an abomination.
Bank says in most of these debates, the view that prevailed didn't look at the flat tax as just a flat tax.
They were thinking about what is the overall burden.
Meaning there were tariffs and excise taxes, things that affected the poor and the rich differently. Even the draft was part of the debate.
The poor are paying a huge tax by sending their sons off to war.
Taxing the rich more on income was seen as a way to balance all these other taxes that affected the poor more. But Bank says times were simpler back then. Today, a complete restructuring of the tax system from payroll to sales to state, that is a complicated conversation, one that is hard to squeeze into a presidential debate. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Traders got back to their, yeah, we're a little bit grumpy ways today. We will have the details when we do the numbers. We were telling you the other day about the Shishan Wu, that is China's 13th five-year plan. Shishan is 13, Wu is 5. Anyway, we were telling you about it in the catchy earworm music video that state-run media over there put out. That was all in good fun, but there is actual news from that planning process today. Changing the rules that have been mostly in place for 40 or more years, the government has announced it's getting rid of the one-child policy enacted back in the 1970s. 2 is the new limit. We got our China correspondent Rob Schmitz on the phone to tell us more. Hey, Rob.
Hey, Kai.
Big news, yeah, but was it surprising, I guess, is the question.
I don't think it's that surprising. And you're right. This is big news symbolically. You know, today marks an end to an era in China's history when you had an entire generation of only children in much of urban China. So when you look at this through the lens of history, it is important. But when you look at this moment for China's future, it's a little different. I don't think this is going to have as big an impact on China's economy going forward as some people may think. You know, we have to remember here that China is still limiting families to 2 children. And many urban Chinese who now outnumber their rural counterparts feel like they really can't afford more than one child. You know, that said, when I told my 40-year-old babysitter of my 2 sons the news of this when it broke, she told me, you know, gosh, I wish the government would have ended this policy 10 years ago. You know, she was a little sad about it. She and her husband followed the rules. They had one son, and she told me that she and her husband would have definitely had another child if the government would have allowed it, but now she feels like it's too late for them.
Here's the other thing, though, Rob, right? I mean, so many people in China now are moving to the cities, and it is expensive to live in Chinese cities.
It's extremely expensive, but at the same time, you know, for all the people who say, oh, I can't afford another child, on the other hand, China is a very big place. You know, it's not just Shanghai and Beijing. You've got a lot of medium-sized cities out there that are, you know, more affordable to live in, and it also is a very family-centered society. So there are just as many families, I think, that'll opt to have 2 children, and I think, you know, this has been very welcome news for a population that's seen its own economy slow down for the first time in their lives. You know, in some ways, you got to wonder if China's leadership was considering their country's, you know, changing economic realities when they made this decision. You know, China's economy is entering a slowdown period. The country is embarking on an historic transformation from an economy based on building things to one based on consumers buying things, and allowing people to have slightly bigger families, you know, might be the Chinese government's way of throwing its people a bone of sorts, you know, doing something that they know will make its citizens happy because the leadership knows full well that tough times are ahead.
Let me ask you one more thing, Rob, before I let you go. The other news tidbit in this 5-year plan announcement today was that the government's going to be shooting for, and this is a quote, medium-high economic growth as its new target. What does that mean, and what does it mean?
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like how you'd want your steak cooked, you know? I mean, this is, you know, this goes along with another, you know, odd language that the party's using to build a so-called moderately prosperous society, you know?
Wow.
I think the takeaway here is that after decades of incredible economic growth, China's leaders are now resetting expectations a bit so that they can accomplish what needs to be done in order to transform their economy to a consumer-led growth model. This isn't an easy transition to make, and we're already starting to see slower economic growth because of it. So dialing down those expectations for growth to medium high means that, you know, China's government will continue to strive for high growth, but that the reality of an historic economic transformation is likely to get in the way.
Rob Schmitz on the ground for us in Shanghai. Thank you, Rob.
Thanks, Kai.
We've been spending a lot of time this week on the results of our National Economic Survey, the Marketplace Edison Research Poll, and how, for a whole lot of people in this country, the economic recovery doesn't really feel like one. Student loans are a big part of that story. Half the people we heard from who are paying off student debt are having difficulty making the payments. And they're not necessarily, by the way, the young underemployed millennials we've heard so much about. 2/3 of college debt in this country is owed by people over the age of 30. So from the Marketplace Education Desk at WYPR, Amy Scott talked to some of them.
When Tanya McAneer opens up her small boutique in San Diego's South Park, she's greeted by a skull in a wedding veil on display for Halloween.
It's a good day in South Park, Bad Madge. This is Tanya.
The shop, Bad Madge and Company, sells an eclectic mix of mid-century furniture and vintage fashion.
Right now I have these red velvet swag lamps from the 70s, and they look directly out of the Playboy Mansion. They're just amazing.
McAneer isn't just a small business owner. She also produces fashion shows and teaches fashion merchandising at the college level. For a long time, she did that with just an associate's degree. But back in 2008, when the economy was in the dumps, her profession was changing too.
A lot of the fashion college was requiring a bachelor's degree.
So at the age of 41, McAneer joined a growing crowd of adults who went back to school during the recession. She had to work, so she signed up for an online program at the Academy of Art University, a for-profit college based in San Francisco. At about $2,400 per course, it was pricey. Like most students, she needed loans.
To be honest with you, I didn't really think about the debt. I felt like, you know, with my degree, I could continue teaching, continue having my own business and having several streams of income.
That's not how it worked out. Just as McAneer was about to finish her degree, the small fashion college where she taught shut down. Her income dropped by two-thirds. As she searched for work, she found that many schools were now requiring a master's. Today, she's teaching a few classes and making a small income from her store and barely making a dent in her $65,000 student loan balance.
As a single woman, I'm 48, and I'm scared for my retirement. I feel like crying when I think about it. Every night I go to bed and go, what am I going to have when I am, you know, in my 70s?
McAneer has a lot of company. Almost 40% of the people we surveyed who are paying off student loans say the education wasn't worth the debt. And the regret can be even greater for those who have less time to pay it off. Anthony Carnevale directs the Georgetown University Center on Education and the Workforce. He says going back to school in mid-career can be a really smart move.
When you combine a mid-career degree with somebody who's got 20, 25 years of work experience and know-how, the effects can be very powerful. Now, of course, the effect lasts for fewer years because you're older.
Adding a lot of debt to the equation makes it even more complicated. The important thing, Carnevale says, is to do the math first.
The older you are, you must be a lot more careful in making the choices. And when you hit 30 grand, which is about the average for debt for a BA, you need to pause and think about that.
Kim Norris did think about it. She's 48 and lives in Jacksonville, Florida. About 10 years ago, Norris realized she needed an associate's degree to advance in the medical billing and coding field.
I was really, really very, you know, concerned about the cost of it, but I felt like the end would justify the means. You know, once I graduate, I'll be able to pay my loans back without a problem.
But when she did graduate from the University of Phoenix in 2008...
people were getting laid off left and right. I actually was laid off once. And to have that competitive edge, you really needed to have something else under your belt.
So she went back for a bachelor's. And when that turned out not to be enough of an edge, she got an MBA.
I'm close to $80,000 in school loans. And I've been struggling trying to find work that will allow me to pay bills and to pay those loans back.
As it turns out, the credentials she's falling back on are the medical billing and coding certificates she got for a few thousand dollars. Both Norris and McAneer and others I talked to say they believe they got a good education, but it wasn't worth the price. Economist Anthony Carnevale says they may just need to wait for the economy to get a little stronger. As it continues to improve, the jobs employers are adding are jobs that require degrees.
And so hopefully, a lot of people who made bad bets several years ago, those bets will begin to pay off.
But older grads with fewer working years ahead of them don't have as much time to wait. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
There's no such thing as too many real voices, actual people on stories like this. So from Miami, Ann Arbor, and Oakland, California, responses to this question, how anxious are you about your student debt?
I'm not scared about having to pay off loans if that means that I get to therefore have the life and the kind of job that I want to.
It's kind of like stagnant how far you can move up. You know, you get out of college and you usually don't work in the field that you studied in.
To live on minimum wage is kind of like unrealistic right now. I'm in college, so trying to get full-time hours and do full-time student and be a single parent, yeah, it's hard.
I'm in school. I plan to not do this forever, but it's going to be several years before I can get on my feet.
You can find all the data from our Marketplace Edison Research National Economic Poll and also all the other stories we've been doing this week based on it at marketplace.org. While you're there, share your story with us too, would you? How your economy feels. Coming up.
I wanted to say that the road is a joyous place and belongs to all of us.
Gloria Steinem on a life lived mostly on the road. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's off 23 points today, about a 10%, closed at 17,755. The NASDAQ down 21 points, 0.4%, 5,074. The S&P 500 dipped less than a 10%, basically flat, 2,089. Allergan, maker of Botox, almost 6% on news that Pfizer has held talks with the company about buying it. Pfizer, the world's second biggest drug maker, dropped 1.9%. Deutsche Bank off 6.8% today after its third quarter results showed a $6.5 billion American dollar loss. The company also said it's going to cut 35,000 jobs over the next 2 years to try to boost profits. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.17%. You're listening to Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Palo Alto Networks. As you innovate to transform your business in today's digital world, how do you stay secure? At Palo Alto Networks, our mission is to protect your digital way of life. Whether it's unprecedented opportunities or uncertainties with AI and whatever comes next, we continually deliver innovation to make each day safer and more secure than the one before. More at paloaltonetworks.com.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. In a slightly horrifying development, this holiday season is going to bring us something new. Toys that talk with kids, like actually talk. Toys that connect to the cloud, even toys that use artificial intelligence. Mattel's new Hello Barbie is the most prominent and controversial example of this. And parents, beware. It hits stores in November. Marketplace's Nova Sappho has the story.
Gone are the days when talking toys had perhaps a few recorded phrases. The new Hello Barbie doll demonstrated at the New York Toy Fair earlier this year can remember what kids have said.
Barbie, what should I be when I grow up?
Like being on stage, so maybe a dancer or a politician.
The technology powering this interaction comes from Toy Talk. Oren Jacob is a co-founder and says the doll can have conversations as long as a half hour.
Underlying Hello Barbie is the raw technology of speech recognition, of natural language understanding and processing, and to some degree of the field of artificial intelligence.
All that technology raised privacy concerns and led to a petition urging toy giant Mattel not to release the doll. It didn't work. Josh Gollan heads the campaign for commercial-free childhood, which led the effort.
One of their main concerns is about the fact that these toys could be used as viral marketing devices. There's nothing to prevent them from talking to children about brands or products or new movies or music.
Toy Talk's Oren Jacob says they're not marketing to children and never will. But what about other toys? There's one using IBM's Watson. Yes, the one from Jeopardy. Others relying on cloud servers to pass around data. Analyst Sean McGowan of Oppenheimer has covered the toy industry for decades. He says some parents may be hesitant to buy smart toys this holiday season, but
in a couple of years, parents will be very comfortable with the idea because they will have seen it in virtually all aspects of their own lives around the house.
And the number of smart toys, McGowan says, will inevitably multiply. I'm Nova Sappho for Marketplace.
A memoir titled My Life on the Road could be about just about anything. The trip, the destination, anything, right? When you find out the author is Gloria Steinem, though, it becomes a bit more focused. Steinem has been synonymous with the women's equality movement for decades now. She founded Ms. Magazine, helped found it, actually, among a whole long list of other achievements. She's now written, as I said, a book. Gloria, good to have you on.
Great to be here. Thank you.
You point out pretty early in this book, which is, just to remind people, called My Life on the Road. You point out that the road really has been sort of a male dominion for a whole lot of history.
Well, if you think about all the big stories of voyages of the Greeks and the Silk Road and through to adventures on motorcycles and so on, it has been presented as a male story. It's kind of ironic because it turns out that females have actually been more likely to travel. But that's because they traveled to another household. And the patrilineal households probably now outnumber the matrilineal households. So I wanted to say that the road is a joyous place and belongs to all of us.
As I was reading this book, I was trying to figure out how you, for the past 40-something years, of which you've spent half your time, you write, on the road, how you made a living out there. Because, you know, there's professional insecurity when you're doing this. And then it occurred to me that you've basically been a freelancer for 45 years, right?
That's true. I've never actually had a job in the conventional sense. And I was well prepared for that by a father who never had a job. Actually, it was a big point of pride with him. He never had a job. But he, what he meant by that was that he was working for himself, you know, that he was in the summertime running a summer resort and in the wintertime buying and selling antiques. But I suppose it prepared me for the what lots of people would see as the insecurity of not having a paycheck, but I just see as normal.
Let me take you to politics for a minute, just because it's sort of the topic of the day in a lot of social conversations now. Hillary Clinton obviously is running. You have supported Democratic candidates in the past. I wonder, though, and this is probably going to be a controversial question, but whatever. I wonder, though, whether if she wins, people will say, oh, well, we've got a woman president now, and feminism, we've got that taken care of, you know?
Well, probably, but that will just be wrong, you know? The people were saying we're living in a post-racist age because President Obama was elected, which is ridiculous. You know, clearly racism is a factor, a huge factor. And the same will be true for women of all races if Hillary Clinton wins. But it will be a huge step forward nonetheless, both because little girls and boys will be looking at the White House and seeing that a female human being is in authority there, and also because the consciousness that comes from walking around your whole lifetime as a female person, an African-American person, it helps you make decisions that include the whole country, not just part of the country.
Do you remember when you, in your mind, came to this job you've had for 45 years of organizer?
That's an interesting question because I experienced it by living in India for a couple of years after I first graduated from college, but I didn't understand that the kind of on-the-road organizing that went on in the, with Gandhian groups in India could apply to this country because in my college education there really had not been much about the suffragist and abolitionist movement, which at any given moment had dozens of people traveling around the country, the Grimke sisters, Frederick Douglass, Sojourner Truth. The movement was created by people on the road speaking. And that is still the case, despite mass communications. There's still something that happens when people are in a room together and can empathize with each other and with all five senses that doesn't happen on the page or on the screen or on the radio.
The most recent book by Gloria Steinem is called My Life on the Road. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
This final note on the way out today, the actual cost of the Volkswagen emissions cheating scandal. The company said yesterday it lost $1.8 billion last quarter, partly as a result of the billions it's had to set aside to pay damages in that case. Today, though, the first peer-reviewed study of the public health costs of all that extra pollution. It was published in Environmental Research Letters and says about 60 people have already died prematurely from all the extra stuff in the air. And that is just in this country. 550,000 affected cars here, 1.2 million of them in the UK. All righty, got to go. A day after the Fed said money was going to stay free for a good long while, maybe December, we don't know. The Dow dropped 23 points, 10%. The NASDAQ off 21 points, 0.4%. The S&P 500 off less than a 0.1%. John Buckley, Deirdre Depke, Eve Epstein, Nancy Fargali, George Judson, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Mark Miller. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.